A piece of glass in his mother's foot changed everything. No grand ambitions, no stage parent dreams, just a random injury that led 7-year-old Tom to a drama teacher who dramatically declared he belonged in the arts. One reading from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at an agency, and suddenly he was flying to America for commercials. His early roles were wonderfully absurd. Playing pea green in The Borrowers meant escaping algebra for Olympic gym training, wearing a ridiculous orange wig, and sporting a ginger mullet that earned merciless teasing at football practice. He spent days in harnesses, dodging giant hammers, and doing 30-foot falls. When Potter auditions arrived, Tom was possibly the only kid who'd never heard of the books. His cluelessness showed when director Chris Columbus asked what scene he most wanted to see on screen. Tom pointed at another kid and said, "Same as him," even flapping his arms, thinking Gringotts might be some flying creature. During a break with cameras secretly rolling, he brushed off a curious frizzy-haired girl asking about the boom mic. "It means they're recording us, obviously," he sneered before walking away. That girl was Emma Watson. That natural arrogance, pure Draco. After weeks of silence and seeing the cast announced in newspapers, Tom pretended not to care and returned to his yo-yo. Then came the callback, not for Harry or Ron, but for Draco Malfoy. His reaction when he finally got the part? "Cool, this should be fun." Then he asked to return to his football game where he was losing 2-1. Unlike his castmates who lived fully in the Potter bubble, Tom split his time, 1 week on set, 1 week at normal school. This made him the Harry Potter wanker to classmates. He overcompensated by smoking, shoplifting, and bunking off PE. Once while fishing, 40 older kids recognized him, threw his rods in the lake, and threatened him with lit cigarettes. Just as violence seemed inevitable, his brother Chris appeared and dispersed the crowd. Another time, someone stole his bike and left a death threat. On set, his day began with a 6 a.m. pickup for the 90-minute journey to Leavesden Studios. After breakfast and collecting daily script sides, which he constantly lost, he'd spend an hour in hair and makeup, sometimes bleaching his roots every 9 days. Then came 3 hours of legally required tutoring, measured by stopwatch. The studios consisted of 8 massive warehouses with incredibly detailed sets, from the Forbidden Forest with real trees to the Room of Requirement packed with wizarding curiosities. Despite sarcastic teachers, indifferent classmates, and cigarette-wielding bullies, Tom remains grateful. Those experiences gave him something real that balanced the fantasy world of filmmaking. While Draco's family was cold and brutal, Tom's real family was close-knit and chaotic. Playing Draco gave him a second family. There's a reason he still calls Jason Isaacs dad. Meeting Jason for their first scene outside Borgin and Burke's terrified him. This charming man offered tea and had everyone laughing with stories. Then suddenly, quiet on set. Jason kept talking. Roll cameras. Jason didn't stop. And action. Mid-punchline, Jason transformed completely, turning with pure hatred. No acting was required for Tom to appear terrified. When they called cut, Lucius dissolved. "My darling boy, did I hurt you?" Jason could become Lucius at the snap of a finger. Ralph Fiennes created an entirely different atmosphere. During the Battle of Hogwarts finale, Ralph made a slight arm movement. Was he trying to hug him? Tom cautiously approached, and Ralph gave perhaps the most uninviting hug ever captured on film. At the London premiere, the audience watched in shocked silence. At the American premiere, they erupted in laughter. Helen McCrory joined as Narcissa in the 6th film, effortlessly cool, quietly rolling cigarettes with licorice papers. When she became Narcissa, something in her eyes revealed both Malfoy coldness and maternal softness. Years after Potter ended, when Emma visited Tom in Venice Beach, they found refuge under a lifeguard stand while people chased them along the boardwalk. Rumors had circulated about their relationship, which Tom denied, despite there being more truth than he admitted. He wasn't in love with Emma, but he loved and admired her in a way he couldn't explain. Kindred spirits who understood each other deeply. Sir Richard Harris played Dumbledore in the first 2 films. Tom had minimal interaction with him, but Harris once took him aside and simply said, "You're good." Tom didn't fully appreciate receiving praise from a legend at the time. Michael Gambon was entirely different, more showman than wise elder, young at heart despite playing the old wizard. Unlike everyone else required to use studio drivers, Gambon drove himself in his Audi R8 or Ferrari. Tom would run from the makeup chair with peroxide and foil in his hair just to check out his car. Tom's most significant scene with Gambon was atop the lightning-struck tower in Half-Blood Prince, where Draco has Dumbledore at one point. He kept stumbling over one line. During a break, Gambon invited him for a breath of fresh air, their code for a cigarette. Outside, Tom apologized profusely. Gambon deadpanned, "Dear boy, do you have any idea how much they pay me per day? At this rate, if you keep fucking it up, I'll have a new Ferrari by next week." The pressure instantly lifted. Alan Rickman initially terrified Tom. Before a take, he warned with his most intimidating Snape-like stare, "Don't step on my fucking cloak." Halfway through the Great Hall, Tom did exactly that. Alan's head jerked back with a strangled, "Ah!" Despite this, Alan quietly insisted Tom be given a proper director's chair to match the veteran actor's height, demanding he be treated as an equal. Now that Alan, Richard Harris, John Hurt, and Helen McCrory have passed, Tom finds himself in a kind of purgatory. Only as an adult does he truly understand their profound influence. Life mirrored art. Just as young wizards learned from brilliant masters in Potter, raw child actors absorbed wisdom from Britain's finest.
Nobody could truly understand Daniel Radcliffe's experience, carrying the franchise's weight from age 11, with paparazzi tracking his every move. No, initially distant, they bonded over cricket matches, Simpsons trivia, and sneaking cigarettes behind studios. Tom recognized their core similarities, both hyper-aware and emotionally sensitive. He believes if he'd been an only child like Daniel, he'd have been more measured. If Daniel had Tom's three rowdy brothers, he might have been more boundary testing. This symmetry mirrors Harry and Draco's parallel paths. When Draco finally gained depth in Half-Blood Prince, director David Yates challenged Tom to evoke empathy for this boy with no real choice. Dominated by his father, coerced by Death Eaters, terrified of Voldemort in his home. Draco's pivotal moment at Malfoy Manor, choosing not to identify the disfigured Harry, reveals why Tom sees them as two sides of the same coin. Harry, product of love, Draco, product of manipulation. Yet when free to choose, they both pick what's right over what's easy. Tom's final Potter scene, Draco leaving battle on a rubble-strewn bridge, never made the final cut. He stayed composed, saying goodbye to the crew, then bawled in the car. Rise of the Planet of the Apes was a one-off success, the first and last time he'd be offered a major role without auditioning. Left to his own devices, he might have abandoned acting for professional fishing. Hollywood auditions humbled him quickly, from being ignored by bored casting directors to bombing with inconsistent American accents. L.A. transformed from lonely wasteland to seductive bubble. Unlike England, where fame met sarcasm, Hollywood massaged his ego with effusive praise and VIP treatment. Designer clothes appeared free, BMW lent luxury cars, velvet robes parted at exclusive clubs. Barney's Beanery became his sanctuary, an old dive bar where he could be himself. He transformed from someone who barely drank to regularly downing pints and whiskey before sunset. The night before his life changed, he spent drinking instead of resting. Arriving at his manager's office, he found seven people waiting, an intervention. Go to rehab immediately or lose their representation. After a dramatic escape and ending things with Jade, Tom faced the truth. Though skeptical about needing rehabilitation, he recognized he'd been using alcohol to mask deeper issues. He promised himself more honesty about his feelings and consciousness about drinking, eventually checking into a smaller, family-run facility where he formed deep bonds with fellow patients. Tom has come full circle. Living in North London with his morning routine of walking his dog Willow at dawn, making his childish ham and cheese sandwich, still cut diagonally, and cycling to the West End for performances. This journey taught him the profound power of storytelling, something he nearly dismissed when auditioning for what seemed like a ridiculous-sounding story about a boy living under stairs. That pivotal night in Malibu when he fled rehab, one of his three kings asked if he was rich. The question haunted him until he understood. True wealth isn't measured in Gringotts gold, but comes from family, helping others, and the ripple effect we have on those around us. Mental health struggles aren't signs of weakness, but common human experiences deserving compassion. The line between Tom Felton and Draco Malfoy isn't black and white, but painted in countless shades of gray. His grandfather helped develop Draco's iconic sneer, teaching him to imagine smiling about something terrible. Though fans sometimes react unexpectedly, from spontaneous tears to crushing hugs, he remembers their reactions reflect the deep importance these stories hold. Each day, he reminds himself how fortunate he is to have a life centered on love, family, and friendship, perhaps the greatest lesson from Harry Potter itself.